Papaji would do very strong things to the people who he loved most, you know, who came to his house most often, part of his family, if you like. Not family, but
his
Sangha family. Yeah. He would definitely be much tougher on those people.
And the people would know why?
Some of them would know why, some perhaps didn't really understand. But, I mean, probably in those days I also wouldn't have understood. But, for example, now I understand the more horrible he was to you, the more he loved you in a way. But that you wouldn't necessarily understand that, of course, unless you had a perspective on it.
Did this way of treating people bring development? Was it a path into freedom for these people who were treated that way, or... Was it?
That's always difficult to judge. You know? The effect of something is hard to judge, I think.
Have you ever met somebody without any structures, where you would say this person did not have any structures anymore?
Probably there's a man who I interviewed for the Indian Blueprints book called Adja. And when I interviewed him, he was in his late 80s. He had a very interesting life story, but anyway, by that time he was having a small ashram with about 12 people, and again there was a tremendous feeling of love in this ashram. When they prepared food or they served food, you could feel the love behind it. It was very beautiful energy, and he was like a funny little man. And he was always laughing, and he seemed a bit crazy, actually. You could easily imagine he's a bit crazy. Very passionate. Tremendous amount of energy for somebody who was... Well, I think the first time I met him, he was about 86, and then later he was getting on for 90, I think. And I would say he would be somebody who comes to mind as somebody having very, very little structures left. To the point that I think sometimes he didn't function. You know, I remember the first time I came to see him, they told me, well, unfortunately, he's not available. He's lying on his bathroom floor. So, you know, I mean, what to say, you know? So, I mean, yeah, I mean... But he was an amazing man. I remember we met him several years, and the last time we met him was about 3 weeks before he left his body.
Yeah.
And we stayed for one night in his ashram. And I remember waking up quite early in the morning, around 6, because some noise outside my window. And I looked out, and maybe 6 men from the ashram, they were moving soil. They were making a kind of roadway. And sure enough, Adja was there directing these 6 guys at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, because, of course, it got very hot in the daytime, so they did this work in the early morning. But there he was, directing this work, you see, 3 weeks before he left his body, probably 88 years old or something like that, you see. And amazing energy, you see, amazing energy. So in that way, I would say probably he has very little structures, because there's very little in the way, you know, just a lot of energy moving, tremendous amount of energy.
Now we come into concepts. But what then stabilizes structures? What are obstacles that stabilize structures and prevent us or prevent people from getting rid of the structures?
Well, of course, the main thing is that we are identified with being a separate somebody. So all these structures, to us, are not really structures. That's who I am. You know, I'm my structures, and I'm my structures, I mean patterns of mind. So we actually are naturally feeling these structures are who I am. Along with my body, that's who I am. So until you come to realize that that's not who you are, then structures are not really structures. They're just who you are, because we're completely attached for most people. But once you get some glimpses of another possibility, then you can also start to become aware of these structures. And here in our community, for example, That's one of the things that we try to be aware about, because here we work together. We have a few businesses. So two or three people will work together on different projects. And so in this working together, everybody acts as a kind of mirror. And in this mirror, if you're sensitive to what's happening, without much talking, you can see your structures. And then in this awareness of seeing the structures, simply by seeing them clearly, they tend to gradually fade. Mm-hmm. And if they're a very traumatic structure, maybe it takes some years to fade. If it's something quite small, unimportant, it fades maybe quite easily. And that's, in a way, what goes on in our community. And to help that process, we came up recently with this idea of having a buddy. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, when you work together with somebody, he or she would become your buddy. And if you have a nice enough connection, you can agree with your buddy that they will remind you when they observe you in a particular structure. Because one of the things that's very interesting is that it's very easy to see somebody else's structures, but it's not at all easy to see one's own structures. Mm-hmm. So by having this buddy system, as long as you can sort of thank your buddy for what he's just told you, because there's always this thing that you can become, you can feel judged. You know? Mm-hmm. And if you take it personally, and therefore you take it also as a judgment, then it's not going to be long before you don't like your buddy very much. But if you appreciate what you're getting from your buddy, then your buddy can be very, very helpful, because he can reflect not just as a mirror, but also he can speak to you and say, hey, look what you just did. You know, do you see this? Mm-hmm. So this is actually something we started fairly recently, and I think it must be working well, yeah? Yeah. Yeah. But of course it doesn't work at all if you take it personally, because then it feels exactly like a judgment, and it feels just like what daddy always did, what mummy always did, and then you don't feel good. So it can be very misunderstood. And I think really it can only work when there's a lot of love, when there's a lot of connection between the people, as we have in our community.
Okay.
And then people are somehow supported by that energy, and then they're able to see these things not personally.
Okay. And then the seeing it not personally also guides into the direction of surrendering this
It's not that you really surrender it, because that's not quite how it works, but what I've experienced is that just by a clear awareness on something, that something can't really bite you anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe it bites you for some time, but gradually it can't bite you anymore.
It is there, but it doesn't bite you anymore.
Mm. And for example, in our community, and I think in the world generally, a lot of people from their childhood, they have this structure of, I'm not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty common, I think. And if you really examine this structure of I'm not good enough, you can see how it's been with you for 30 years maybe, 40 years, you know, 50 years. And, you know, you absolutely, when this message comes, then you absolutely believe it. But how can anybody not be good enough for 40 years? It doesn't make any sense. So when somebody starts to reflect it, at some point you just see, well, that's ridiculous. It's just some sort of irrational message in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Do you support this seeing also with meditations, or guided meditations? Do you do that?
No, I don't do guided meditations, but we do meditate in the community together in the early morning. And as you saw tonight, we have dinner, silent dinner every evening.
And how is the setting for these meditations? Is it just sitting silent? Or
In the morning, we start with it's half an hour of something like yoga, different kinds of yoga or body movements. Different people from the community lead it each morning. Mm-hmm. And then every morning there's half an hour of sitting. So that's the morning one. And then in the afternoon it's something active, and then again sitting quietly. And the evening you saw us just eating dinner together quietly.
And during the sitting period, is there a recommendation, for example, doing things like a body scan?
No, I wouldn't recommend a body scan. My I mean, I'm not really dictating how people should meditate.
Okay.
But my own preference would be that people simply sit quietly and just watch. They don't try to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in addition to those daily meditations, we all also have 4 evenings a week where we have satsang.
Yes.
So then that's also, you know, 3 evenings also on top of the meditation. So actually there's quite a lot of, if you like, quiet time or reflective time.
This space is open then. Mm. Where this
and then in between, we work a lot, quite intensely, mm-hmm. but that's happening together. So it's like you have both a contrast yes. of a lot of silence and also a lot of activity.
Mm-hmm. So no recommendations for the meditation themselves. It's just sitting silent.
Yeah, that would be my preference. But I'm not dictating how people sit.
So the way I learned it and we discussed it on Monday was having a body scan, ideally first, just to get contact with the body, and then already things can happen. And also to put oneself in an accepting state, so just neutrally observing what there is and not judging and accepting.
Mm.
And somehow, I personally, for me, this does very well.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I think there are many, many methods of meditation.
Yeah.
And I think in the end, it's better that people continue what they're accustomed, you know, what they enjoy in a way.
Yes. Mm. I think somehow the system seems to resonate with what is done, and it finds its way itself to a certain extent.
I mean, the other thing I could mention is that as part of our work time, or in fact part of our whole day, I'm encouraging people very much to do what I call self-inquiry, what Ramana Maharshi calls self-inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a conscious looking to see where the thoughts arise from. So rather than as normal, we take a thought, you know, and immediately within split part of a second, we're saying it's my thought. So I'm talking, for example.
Okay.
So this is a reflective way of examining who is talking, actually, who is talking. So by this self-inquiry, it's taking us inside and taking us to the source, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that some people do quite intensely, or over a period of a year they have, you know, intense times of doing it, and perhaps they forget and then they don't do it for some time. But this is very much a central suggestion from me for the community. And when I have a retreat, we would then do it formally, kind of with my support. So it's very much something that I'm always encouraging.
So from where do the thoughts arise?
Yes. To ask this question, basically, who am I? Who is this I? And by asking this question, you come to, in fact, the source of the I.
Do you have such sessions really asking these questions, or do you call up people to this chair and have dialogues on this, who am I, who do you believe you are, or diets or whatever is available as methodology?
Actually, we do both things. When we have a retreat situation, I have a format of people sitting together, looking in each other's eye, and then one person will ask this question to the other. They'll say, well, who are you? And then you have 5 or 6 minutes, and you talk and tell the person what you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we close our eyes, and then there's some reflection, you know, is this really who you are? So each person is reflecting, and then you change over. And we do this for some hours. And this is always very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
very often out of a group of people, several people will have an immense glimpse, because somehow the effect of the eye contact and the focus on this question together, it just brings people into a deep silence. And so often people will get very touched. People who have never done it before, who are kind of innocent, they get very, very touched perhaps. And somebody who, we've got people here who have done it, a few thousand times maybe. No, I'm exaggerating. But I mean, the people who've done it for quite a few times, They will also often have very profound glimpses. So this is something that we do in a retreat situation, in a group situation. I also have a little format where somebody would come and sit with me, and I would do something like that just on a one-to-one basis. But that's a little bit different because usually I do that with the suggestion of looking whatever is going on. So people close their eyes, they look, and they might say, oh, a lot of thoughts now about dinner or something. And I say, okay, well, just stay with those thoughts, just accept the thought, don't try to change anything. And usually very quickly, people go through maybe some feelings, some body sensations, and I say, accept it, accept it, accept it. And usually quite quickly, well, it depends if there's a support of a group of group energy, then maybe in 20 minutes, people come to silence, emptiness. And they start off, you know, maybe very kind of, and very quickly they just fall into this empty space. And often people are quite surprised. So I do that more on a one-to-one basis.
And do you recommend the people to stay as much time as possible in that state?
Well, I recommend them to always stay in that state. I mean, if it's possible, but you see, it's not possible because, you know, the reality is that, and even when you've clearly awakened, I mean, if I look back on my own last 20 years of my own life, I can see that, if you like, I've become more and more in this emptiness over the 20 years. But in the initial period of years, there was still quite a lot of structures appearing and then disappearing. So when a structure is there, of course, then you can't really stay in that emptiness. You get caught up with something. And so in our daily life, it seems to me that, you know, there's one thing about seeing, realizing, if you like, truth, and there's another aspect to actually living the truth. We could call this embodying truth. So, and again, one of the things that's going on in this community is that because we're all kind of focused towards that, the daily life is encouraging people to really ground the energy in the daily tasks. So in one way, our community doesn't look very spiritual. You know, we're not all walking around in silence with our noses in the air, you know, being frightfully kind of, you know, spiritual. So probably for somebody coming into the house for the first time, well, they might be touched by the energy. I'm told, I can't really judge it, but I'm told there's a lot of energy when you come into the house, so people can feel that energy. But then if they look around, they'll see people running here and running there. We're like a lot of ants when we're working. So they might not find that very spiritual. But if you take the whole week, then I think we could say we're a kind of spiritual community.
But what is spiritual? No. I have to ask this question. What is spiritual?
Well, years ago, I had lots of good ideas about that. But now I would say that actually there isn't anything like spiritual. You know, it's just life itself is spiritual. Everything is spiritual.
Or not spiritual.
Or not spiritual, whatever you mean by spiritual. You know, but people mix up, I think, you know, ideas about monks and, you know, a kind of
ideas, imaginations, or expectations.
I think people have ideas about what spiritual is, you know, and it's a lot to do with a certain serious kind of silence or something, I think, perhaps. And that's not happening in our community. I mean, we have these periods of meditation, of course. We have our meetings when there's a lot of silence. But we're also, if you like, doing an ordinary life. So we've got these businesses to run, phone calls to make. We have to go shopping for our food. We have to look after the kids. So we're doing all kind of ordinary stuff, too. And in a way, the whole effort is to kind of embody this opening that's happened in the daily life, so to become present in the moment, whatever you're doing. I would say that's the intention of the community.
Yeah. This being present, then this bypassing the structures. Yeah, when this presence is there.
Yeah, the thing that stops us really being present is that we have some structure operating. Yeah. And exactly. One of the things we've also discovered over the years of living together, that almost everybody has some kind of trauma, which is like a strong structure.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, of course, have had some physical violence. Some people have had sexual violence. If you like, emotional violence when they were small.
Mm-hmm.
But almost everybody seems to have had something that was not a normal, kind of normal structure, something you could call a trauma. And that is not usually very obvious when you first meet people. It may even take a year before it would kind of come out. But as we've been living together for longer than a year, we are aware of certain people having these particular structures, traumas.
Traumas, okay.
Yeah.
And do you give the feedback, do you discuss these traumas with the people? Is there open communication about this?
Yeah. We have meetings like this where we would talk about the traumas. And maybe if somebody, it's not always, people don't always see their traumas. Or maybe they, on some deeper level, they know they have a trauma, but it's been blocked out.
Yeah.
It's very common with early violence or sexual violence that people kind of block it, you know, so there's no conscious understanding of the trauma. The trauma is kind of, subconscious.
It's subconscious programming.
But when you live together with somebody like that, you gradually notice that in certain situations, poof, they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've come to realize is that if you have a very strong trauma, the chances are that in order to deal with the pain of it when you are small, the body mechanism kind of took you out of your body. Seems to be quite common. So if the pain was very intense, then the human organism just left the body so that you could survive in a way as a small person.
Yeah.
And then when you're an adult, you may still have this habit that when a trauma gets triggered, poof, not there. You know? So, I mean, this is one of the things that the buddy system is helping. Yes. Helping people to see, you weren't really there for the last hour.
Okay.
And, of course, in order to be able to say that to somebody, there has to be love, there has to be a feeling of well-being. Otherwise, you just feel judged, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as you cannot consider this as a support, yeah? bringing light into the own structures or whatever it is. Yeah?
Mm.
And how to overcome such traumas? What is the experience there?
Not easy, actually. Not very easy. It seems that, if somebody doesn't really know much about their trauma, I would probably encourage them to have some trauma sessions with a therapist who's been trained for that kind of understanding. And we have one person in Cologne who several people in the community has been there to see this particular woman. And they nearly all find that she has some skill at kind of opening up what maybe has been closed. And maybe for a shorter time, maybe some days, people kind of feel they've been released from the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't usually last very long, unfortunately. So it seems that these traumas, they're not so easy to escape, you could say.
Did you yourself have a trauma? Or somehow liberate you from trauma? So what is your personal experience? Obviously, you are an awakened person, and somehow I assume this must have been overcome, if there was any. Yeah?
I remember after some years, maybe after 10 years of doing kind of what you could call spiritual work, meditating, I came to see that I have a structure which is kind of afraid of life. And I didn't really understand it because my memory of my parents was that I actually, I liked them and it seemed everything was pretty okay. And then I discovered, of course, I was born in 1944. So I was born just at the end of the last war. And my situation was that I lived with my mother, who was about 20. And my father was a doctor and he was busy in the war. And I'm pretty sure that when I was very small, my mother had a lot of fear about the situation because she'd previously lost her first husband 3 or 4 years before. She lost her first husband when she was very young. And so I have a feeling when I was in her body and when I was in my first year or two, there must have been an energy of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, reading newspapers, the radio, maybe even there were planes and bombs and things. I don't know, really. So anyway, I have that trauma, I think. I think that was a trauma. And gradually, I had this sense that the fear that I could feel in certain situations was triggering this, if you like, an old memory of whatever was going on when I was very small. So I would say that was a trauma. And I would say probably, if I'm very honest, it still has, there's still a shadow of that.
Okay.
So in certain situations, I can get shaky, if you like, even now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the difference now from, say, 30 years ago is that there's an awareness about it,
mm-hmm.
and in a way there's a freedom about it. So although it may come and grab me, it can be seen fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm. You can sense it. You can see.
You can sense something is... something is tightening in the body.
This energy is coming now, yeah.
And therefore, somehow it's sensed. So after some time, you know, I would just sit and it would dissipate.
Now, yesterday I had a discussion with a friend in Cologne last night, and we discussed about such topics, and particularly he just says he cannot sense when a structure is playing out in him. Yeah? So something happens and gone he is, and he cannot sense it. He cannot sense it right in the beginning, and then it plays itself out. So this awareness of now this sensitivity for a structure playing itself out seems to be a good.
I think it needs years of awareness, actually. Yeah. You know, I mean, I've been doing this kind of things for years, but probably it's only in the more recent years, say last 15 years or something, I would really be able to see those things. And probably people that know me very well might even say that they think I still don't see some things, and I would say they're probably right.
Yeah.
So this is quite interesting, because I remember when Papaji was about 86, the person who was writing about his life asked him about these structures. And they asked him, well, Papaji, you know, do you ever get kind of lost in these structures? And his answer was, ever vigilant.
Ever vigilant, I'm sorry.
Vigilant. Ever vigilant, meaning that he was always watching, if you like. He was always...
He was expecting it any moment.
Yeah, something like that, you know. So, I mean, I wasn't personally, I wasn't close enough to him personally to really know what, you know, what that would mean. But if he said that, then presumably even at his age and with all his wisdom and tremendous energy, there were certainly certain situations where he also got something to trigger.
Mm-hmm.